the Emperor's New Drugs, Exploding the Antidepressant Myth. Dr. Irving Kirsch is a professor who's been studying antidepressants, fully thought that he would find that there was proof that antidepressants worked in the case of the most severely depressed. He didn't. In fact, what he ended up doing was proving that antidepressants are a placebo, and that the real cause that we've been claiming as being the cause of antidepressants, this sort of chemical imbalance in the brain, is a myth, and that there are things you can do about it, and he'll tell us about what we can do about depression coming up tonight. Let him make his case. We'll start by talking about placebos in just a second. And before I go, let me read to you a modified version of what's on the front, one of the first pages in the book. And this is to speak directly to this show as well. So I'll use his disclaimer for a disclaimer for us. The information in the following show is not a substitute for professional advice on specific emotional issues. Please consult your doctor before changing, stopping, or starting any medical treatment, specifically antidepressant medication. So far as the author is aware, I'll throw in the host as well, the information given is correct and up to date as of the 3rd of September, 2009. And wow, what information that is. Coming up next on Coast to Coast, this is Ian Punnett. Dr. Irving Kirsch has the pedigree to make the claims. He certainly has done the work on this. Originally from New York, lives in England tonight, though we're catching you on sort of a bad line, as I understand it. Is it better now, Dr. Kirsch?
Yes, I hope it is. I'm hearing well on this end.
Oh, that's great. Oh, yeah. No, that's actually much better than I was fearing. He's a professor emeritus at the University of Connecticut. And now is a professor of psychology at the University of Hull in the UK. And I would say, judging by the photo of you on the book flap,
right,
you're the best-looking man named Irving Kirsch that's ever walked the planet.
That's a real compliment. Thank you.
I mean that. Good-looking guy. So this is a fascinating subject for me, mostly because I don't suffer from depression. But I know people who do, and I know that they have gone through many different types of therapies, and it's been very difficult for them. And everybody is looking for kind of a silver bullet for ongoing depression issues. And for years now, people have been hoping it's just the right cocktail of these SSRIs and the other drugs that go along with them to balance out the side effects. And yet on this show, on Coast to Coast, Dr. Kirsch, you should know, we've been talking about this subject, about whether or not the SSRIs were just placebos, or whether they did more harm than good, for at least 10 years on this show. And I think we were way out in front of the story. So a lot of what you write about in the book, I think you'll find a friendly audience to hear, although, you know, we still get lots of emails from people who say, I couldn't get through my day without my antidepressants. And I imagine you're getting a lot of mail like that yourself.
I have gotten some mail like that. I get a lot of mail also just thanking me and letting me know that they've had trouble with antidepressants, and that this gives them some hope, and that it gives them some hope in understanding that when they've done better, it's not necessarily because of the pill, and it doesn't mean they have to stay dependent on the pill. And some of them get freed from the pill without relapsing back into depression. So I get all kinds of calls with other people that just believe they need that antidepressant, and that if they don't take it, they're going to be depressed again. There are others who take antidepressants, continue taking them, and still feel depressed. And I think those are the people that I am most concerned about, because they're getting all of the negative effects without getting any of the benefits, even of the placebo effect in that case.
Well, and I want to get back to all of that and so much more. And the placebo effect is where I want to start, though, because that was your original interest, was in studying placebos. And I find that a fascinating subject anyway. So talk a little bit about your work, as you were not out to debunk antidepressants. You were studying the placebo effect in these drug studies.
You're absolutely right. I've been studying the placebo effect for years before I touched depression and antidepressants. It was a long-standing interest of mine. Placebos are just absolutely fascinating.
I'm with you.
You can give somebody a substance that has absolutely nothing in it, no chemically active ingredient, and it can cause all kinds of effects, and the effects depend on what you tell the person the effects are going to be. And they may depend on more subtle features, too, like the color of the pill you give them, whether it's a capsule or a pill, whether you give it to them by injection. All of that kind of thing can make an effect. But this is clearly an effect that the mind is having on the mind and the mind is having on the body, that information is having on the mind and body. And it was something that, as a beginning researcher, I was very interested in.
Well, you should be. And I think this is I want to spend a little time on this before we get back into the antidepressant myth, as you describe it. Because I'm curious about that, and I don't know whether you've come to many conclusions about this. But as you just said there, it seems as though you can give somebody a pill, let's call it just a sugar pill, and you're going to give this to them and you're going to tell them that this will have a specific effect on maybe even a specific part of their body. And then it does, and they report feeling better. What percentage of people actually are better, not just feeling better, but when you give them a pill and tell them this will fix problem X, how often does a placebo actually fix the physical problem X that they were experiencing?
You know, it depends on so many factors. It depends on what problem X is. For some problems, placebos do wonders. For depression, placebos do wonders, for example. For anxiety, placebos do wonders. For pain, it does wonders. For asthma, you can get a nice substantial effect of a placebo.
For asthma?
Yeah. For there are other conditions like bone fractures, the healing of a fracture in the bone, where you're not likely to get much of a placebo effect at all. In trying to control blood levels, sugar levels in the blood, placebos don't seem to do anything at all. So it depends what condition it is you're trying to address, and then how you administer the placebo, what you tell people about it, whether you tell them, for example, well, this may be a placebo or it may be the real drug, you'll get an effect that way. Or if you tell them this is a strong treatment that works, you'll get a much larger effect and an effect on a larger number of people. So the placebo effect can vary anywhere from affecting nobody with some particular conditions to affecting almost everybody.
Well, and that's at the core of my question is how much can the brain, the physical brain, not the mental part of the brain where, you know, we imagine things, but how much can the physical brain do to change the chemistry, the body chemistry, or the way in which we are utilizing that organ, let's say the lungs, for example, how much can it change the way that we're using the lungs that keeps asthma at bay, for example? How much can the brain actually do to affect a physical change in the body, not just our perception about what's happening?
Now, we are in the infancy of this, of understanding how the brain specifically produces these and other effects. We've got a brand new technology, things like what are called fMRI, new ways of scanning the brain, and we're at the infancy of it, but we already have learned quite a bit. We know that the brain can do a marvelous job in dilating air passages and constricting them. So they can behave like it can produce the effects of asthma medication and actually opening up air pathways, and it can also produce asthmatic-like symptoms by closing them. And we've known that for a few years. How the brain does that, that remains a big question, and there's a flurry of research right now addressing what are the brain mechanisms involved when you get these phenomenal effects that you get on patients with conditions like osteoarthritis of the knee and asthma and so on.
You know, you mentioned painkillers. And I am one that takes, if I'm having surgery, for example, I'm told this by both dentists and doctors, that I require a lot more anesthesia than the average person. I don't know why, but they say that, you know, think the amount of anesthesia that they, for example, a dentist would put into my mouth before doing a root canal, it can be close to twice as much as they would do with somebody else. And this has happened so consistently throughout my life. I had surgery about a year ago or something, and the doctor said that he literally ran out of the amount of the anesthetic that he could put in my body, and I could still feel stuff. And he was tapping me with pins, and I was feeling it in areas that he said, there's no way you should be feeling this. Is that just a mental thing then in my case? What's the mind-body connection there?
It's hard to know in any particular case. Maybe it's a mental thing. On the other hand, maybe you have a higher set point or a lower set point, a greater sensitivity to stimulation. Maybe you have a greater sensitivity to stimulation beyond that of pain. Have you ever tried any mental control techniques for dealing with pain? They can be effective for many people.
Well, I will tell you that I was actually raised in the tradition known as Christian Science. So we weren't,
yeah.
I didn't have any painkillers ever until I was in my 20s. I think was the first time I ever took something like that. And so I'm sort of on board with it. And I've done a lot of Buddhist meditation techniques. So mm-hmm. I'm good with that. It just happens to be that particularly when it comes to dentists, I'm astounded that that is consistently true, no matter what dentist I've gone to, that they've always said the same thing. I'm beginning, I sort of surrendered to it. I stopped trying to sort it out. And I always now, when I go in, I just tell them, by the way, apparently I have this, you know, unique superpower that it's difficult to, for whatever it's worth. But I've sort of, so anyway, I've always been fascinated in the mind-body connection. And in this case, too, even before we get back to the antidepressant myth of the Emperor's New Drugs, we're talking with Irving Kirsch, PhD in England, that the story here is that placebos are still mysterious and that they're understudied, but that there's a tradition in our medicine. You even had a quote in the book somewhere, I can't remember, I don't think I highlighted it, but it was about how all medicine is placebo. What was that quote?
Yes. I can't remember word for word, but it's something to the effect that is most of the history of medicine up until maybe 100 years ago, maybe less, is really a history of the placebo effect.
That's what it is.
That came out of the work of a distinguished American physician, Arthur Shapiro, and it's a paraphrase of what he had said about that after studying the history of the placebo effect and the history of medicine for many, many years.
Well, and I think that that's fascinating because you even talk about how, and we'll get back to this as it pertains to antidepressants, that in a way, a lot of modern medicine is still sort of, you know, pardon the term, voodoo medicine, in that you tell somebody, it could be, you know, hold this chicken leg and, you know, dance around in a circle three times. But if you tell somebody it's effective, it'll be effective. That's no different than a witch doctor saying, you know, if I, you know, throw these three horse teeth into a circle, it means you're cursed. And people start to believe that they're cursed.
It's a wonderful cure, by the way, for hiccups, is the prescription you gave with chicken.
Is it really? I didn't know that. But that's where I think that's why it's so fascinating. And then a lot of things that we would have called, you know, old wives' tales actually are pretty good medicine. They actually, you know, a lot of things that they're not sophisticated, but they've been passed down for generations and they turn out to be effective. I guess in a way that we circle back to the antidepressants. in that the as you studied, you were studying placebos and the placebo research when you started to study the studies on antidepressants. Talk a little bit about how you got into that.
Sure. Again, I had been interested in the placebo effect. I wasn't particularly interested in antidepressants as an area of study. I used them. I was a clinical psychologist. I had clients. I referred them to psychiatrists if they were very depressed to get them medication. I assumed the medications worked. But I was always interested in this ability of the mind, of a person's beliefs, of their expectations to affect their behavior. And as a researcher, I was at the University of Connecticut. I was looking for places to study that. And it occurred to me that there ought to be a reasonably strong placebo effect in the treatment of depression, regardless of whether it be treatment by pills or by psychotherapy or by anything else. And the reason I thought there ought to be is that depressed people, almost by definition, are hopeless. The sense of hopelessness that just colors depression, and that is central to it. People feel that the world is lousy, their lives are lousy, the depressed state is lousy, and none of it's ever going to get better. It's just hopeless. Well, when you give somebody a treatment, whether it's a placebo treatment or a real treatment, but you give someone a treatment that carries a sense of hope that things are going to change, that this treatment is going to make, if nothing else, it's going to make the depression better, that counters that sense of hopelessness and ought to, therefore, in and of itself, just that belief that I may be getting better given because I have this new treatment, ought to make you feel less depressed. So that's what I wanted to look at in my research, and the only reason that I looked at data from drug trials at all is because that was the only place I could find trials in which people were treated with placebo.
All right, I'm going to extrapolate something here from what you just said. Am I getting this wrong? That the more likely a physical situation is to be hopeless, the more likely a placebo will have an effect.
The more that hopelessness itself, see, hope is a belief. Hopelessness is a belief, so is hope. Hopelessness is the belief that things are bad and they are never going to get better. It's an expectation that things are not going to get better. So when you are dealing with a disorder like depression, where people believe things are not going to get better, any intervention that gives them the sense, yes, maybe they will get better.
Okay, well, let me pull back the lens on that a little bit. I meant that in a broader sense, when you're studying placebos,
right.
If somebody has an ongoing problem and they've been unable to address it and they've gone to 15 doctors and then somebody says, here's your pill. It's the plaid pill. It's Efixol. If you take this, it will go away. That the more desperate they are, the more susceptible they might be to placebos. Is there a connection there?
Could be. The more they believe that the treatment is going to help them, certainly the more they're likely to get an effect.
Okay.
The worse off they are in the beginning, that's a little tricky. Sometimes that can produce a stronger effect, and sometimes it can produce a slightly weaker effect, and that's we've been looking at those data, and that's a bit tricky. But certainly, the more confidence the person has in the treatment they're taking, the more likely the treatment is to work.
But it's confidence in the pill as opposed to the need for the pill that becomes the deciding factor. Okay. Well, that sets the table for the rest of this conversation with Dr. Irving Kirsch, the Emperor's New Drugs. And so when we return to this in just a minute, we'll pick it up right there. Dr. Kirsch starts looking at the studies that have been done and starts doing what they call meta-analysis. So the overarching analysis that ties all of these analyses together. And he sees a pattern. And this is where he begins to start exploring, okay, maybe antidepressants only work in the most severe cases. Maybe they only work under certain types of circumstances. Well, the more he looked into it, the more he realized that they don't work at all any better than a placebo does, that the effect of an antidepressant is very different. He'll explain just what that effect is as we talk about this throughout the night. You're going to find this fascinating, especially when we get into what really is causing the problem on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett. Dr. Irving Kirsch is a professor of psychology in England, formerly in the United States. So the Emperor's New Drugs, Exploding the Antidepressant Myth, you start off looking at placebos, and you end up looking specifically at antidepressants. And you actually, I mean, from an early point, you see that the ratio from the placebo effect to the actual drug effect are pretty close to each other right out of the box. Even the best research says they're pretty close to begin with.
Yeah, but this was absolutely surprising to me. I didn't expect that. I expected to see a reasonably strong placebo effect. That's what I went into the research looking for. But I also thought there would be a strong drug effect because, like everybody else in our culture, I was brought up to believe that. It's what I learned even watching advertisements on television, reading books, hearing lectures, reading journals.
It's a miracle drug.
This is transform the treatment of depression. And lo and behold, we analyzed the data. We only analyzed the data on the antidepressants because we have them. We only have them because that's where we find patients being given placebos and evaluated, and we find that 75% of the response to the drug appears to be a placebo effect. And
now people may hear that. Yeah, people may hear that and they go, well, that I'm in the percent that is not the placebo effect. I'm in the part that's the real effect of the drug.
Right. But, you know, the way it works is not so much like 75% of the people. It's more like, look, I'm feeling a lot better than I used to feel before I started taking the drug. What these data told us is most of that improvement that you are feeling, most of it was not produced by the chemical in the drug. Most of it was improved by your knowledge that you were taking the drug, your hopes about its effect, your beliefs about its effect.
And that means that you could look at it statistically and you could say that if you're feeling better, you take the pill today. Again, we're just simplifying it. You take the pill today,
right.
You feel better tomorrow. 75% of the reason why you're feeling better tomorrow is the placebo effect. The overwhelming active ingredient, if you will, is a non-active ingredient other than the mind's belief that something is getting better.
That's absolutely right, except that it turns out that the 75% figure is an underestimate. That's what it came out
right
when we did our first analysis looking at the published clinical trials that had been done. But we later went back to the data that the Food and Drug Administration had, the data that the drug companies had sent to them in the process of getting the drugs approved, and we analyzed those data, and what we found is that there were many, many trials in which the drugs turned out to be absolutely no more effective at all than the placebo, and these trials just hadn't been published. So if you read the journal literature and you analyzed the trials that had been published, you got this overestimate of the drug effect.
So right away you saw 75% of the effect was placebo, but the more you looked into it, the higher that percentage went until
absolutely
you got to a point where it's really 100%. I mean, it really comes down to is 100% of the effect of getting better is the belief that you're getting better.
I would, in the long run, make that argument. I went from 75% to thinking that it was 82%. That's really leaving very little for a drug effect. But still, overall, across all of the studies, published, non-published, there was this small difference, 15-16% difference between the effect of the drug and the effect of the placebo, and the question was, where did that come from? And at this point, I think I know where it came from, and I think there are a lot of data to point that even that small difference is really a what you could call an enhanced placebo effect, a souped-up placebo effect. But even that is due to the placebo effect, leaving nothing as a real chemical effect.
Let's delay a little bit a discussion about what actually is happening with these drugs, but in terms of depression. But anytime you take something into your body, you can have an effect. If I take, if I eat 2 ounces of Stilton cheese before I go to bed, it'll have an effect on my dreams. If I eat chocolate, it'll have an effect on my body. It may be a mood enhancer. It may be if I eat, So what is obviously these drugs are drugs. I mean, they're doing something to the body. What are they doing to the body? If they're not treating depression, what is Paxil? What is Zoloft? What are these drugs actually doing to our biochemistry?
Well, one thing they're doing is they're producing side effects. These are, as you mentioned, active drugs, active medications. They do have effects on the body. They can produce sexual dysfunction, insomnia, dry mouth, tremors, a whole host of negative symptoms. They can increase the risk of suicide for depressed young people, both adolescents and young adults as well. So they do have effects that the placebos don't have. The problem is most of the effect, if not all of the effect that they seem to have on helping people get better from depression, all of that seems to be a placebo effect.
Are all of the side effects negative?
That's a good question. I haven't thought about that. Certainly all of the side effects that are listed, and it's a long, long list in the brochures that come with the drugs, are negative effects, some being relatively mild, some of them being quite serious. Okay. I haven't seen a positive one listed.
I want to highlight what you just said there. You're talking about the sexual side effects.
Yeah.
This is in regard to the nymphomania?
No, this is in regard to sexual dysfunction, erectile dysfunction, loss of sexual desire, loss of sexual ability. And that's one of the side effects that's specific to SSRIs.
I've heard the argument that there are many people who have the side effect of increased arousal, in the sense that they find themselves sexually compulsive that they had never been before. That's not anything you came across?
No, I haven't come across that.
I'd actually gotten from somebody who studies this subject, who has appeared on the show before as a guest, sent me a recent, it's sort of a nascent study, but it's interesting. There's many people who claim that being on antidepressants makes them sexually compulsive in a way that's inconsistent with anything they've ever done before. So somebody who is, for example, heterosexual might find themselves cruising gay bars all of a sudden when they went on the drugs, and when they went off of them, they lost any desire to do that. There was nothing that they could explain. And women who had no history of nymphomania, for example, suddenly found themselves insatiable until they got off of the drugs. And I thought that was a curious kind of thing. That I don't know that they've done anything, how much they've done on it that's empirical, but anecdotally, that would be very scary if I were taking one of these drugs.
That would be scary, and it would be interesting to see what the evidence on it. It reminds me of one side effect that has some very serious consequences that sometimes happens on SSRIs, and that's a condition in which a person goes into a kind of a very manic state, agitated manic state that then gets associated with acts of violence, both against others and towards the self, and that seems to be linked to the increase in suicide risk that you have when young people and young adults are prescribed antidepressant medication.
Well, and we've seen fairly consistently, again, I don't know how much of it's done at a peer-reviewed level, but a person who's appeared on the show frequently has made the argument that a much higher percentage of these office or school shooters are actually on the antidepressants when they commit the crimes, and that they experience a kind of disassociation, almost sort of an LSD effect, where they're not sure what's real. They're agitated. They want to die. They want to kill other people before they die. And they are experiencing almost a kind of a discontinuity to their life. And so I thought that was compelling in light of the number of office shootings, particularly in the United States, have been done by people who were being treated, actively treated for depression on these antidepressants and still did these crimes. Any thought on that?
Well, I know that has featured in some of the trials in cases of shootings. That was a feature in one of the concerns in the Columbine shooting incident. So, yeah, it's hard to know. It's always hard to determine in any particular case what is it that's caused the behavior in this particular case. But certainly that kind of state that is induced in a minority of people, not most people, but
right,
in a minority of people who are given antidepressant medications could be linked to that kind of violence.
We're talking with Dr. Irving Kirsch, the author of The Emperor's New Drugs, Exploding the Antidepressant Myth. So that's, again, those are some of the side effects, potential side effects. But the important part is that the actual effect, the main effect, the intended effect of these SSRIs is to cure depression or to manage depression. And that's what Dr. Kirsch says is not actually happening. How you describe it, I thought it was interesting. You said that it's treating the depression that somebody has about being depressed. Can you explain that? I think that's interesting.
Sure. As I mentioned before, depressed people are hopeless. They think bad things that are happening to them now are going to continue happening forever. And if you ask them, what is it that you're most hopeless about? What is it that you're depressed about? What many of them will tell you is, well, the worst thing in my life is being depressed. There's nothing as bad as that sense of depression going on in my life. And these people are depressed about their own depression. They're stuck in this vicious cycle where they feel themselves in this blue, sad state. They can't sleep. Their life seems meaningless. They're having a hard time getting any enjoyment out of things that used to give them enjoyment. All of those are symptoms of depression. And that very state is what they now see as the worst thing in their life and what they feel hopeless about, because they feel like I'm going to be stuck here forever. Nothing's going to ever get me out of this bad place. So what you need to do with those people is find a way to switch them from being in a negative cycle into a positive cycle, where they begin by having some hope, some positive expectations, so that they start interpreting things in a positive light rather than in a negative light. And that can do an amazing amount to help relieve their depression.
But that's the part then where you're treating their depression about being depressed, and then that there's a domino effect. Once they start feeling optimistic about their depression, then they start to lose that sense of hopelessness that has been the core of their depression.
That's absolutely right. It works in both ways. That's the way depression can come on, by having a negative domino effect. And that's the way you can break through it, by having a positive domino effect.
If they advertised the drug that way, as a placebo that will give you hope about your hopelessness, would that be a fair representation of the drug, in your opinion, Dr. Kirsch?
Well, if they advertised it as a placebo, in a sense, making it clear that taking the placebo effect works, we know it works. Taking a drug, even though there's nothing active within the drug, the act of taking the drug may help you get better. That would be fair in terms of being honest. We don't know how effective it would be if you administered it that way.
Right, because people have to not know that it isn't really having a physical effect in order for the placebo to have a physical effect.
Or more precisely, I think, they have to believe that the treatment is going to have an effect. If someone goes into the situation and says, okay, I know it's a placebo, but I think it will work for me anyway, then it's likely to work. I don't know how many people would reach that conclusion. That's the problem.
Right. But there's the active participation by the person involved. They have to, in some way, mentally, they have to be involved in it. If you took the placebo, for example, and you put it in their food every day, and they didn't know they were taking the placebo, it could have no possible placebo effect.
That's very true. And for that matter, if you took an antidepressant and you put it in people's food every day without them knowing that they're getting an antidepressant, it will have lots of effects because it produces its side effects chemically. It is an active drug, but it might have no antidepressant effect at all.
This is so fascinating to me. Thank you so much for your patience and all of these questions. We're talking about the Emperor's New Drugs. I mentioned the commercial, like if that was how they advertised it, then that would be fair, you thought, although you don't think it would be effective. Oddly enough, the fairer you are in the representation of the advertising, the less effective it will be as a placebo. But what they do say, and they show it in the commercials, is they use this sort of clever cartoony animation of what the serotonin problem is in the brain and how these serotonin uptake inhibitors stop the flow of the bad flow of the brain's biochemicals. You've seen those commercials?
Yeah, I certainly know the serotonin theory, and this is one of the big surprises to me again during the process of doing this research, was to discover that it's an absolute myth. The data that we have now says that it cannot work, that serotonin, lack of serotonin can't be the cause of depression.
Okay, because that's what it shows. It shows the flow of serotonin in the brain. It almost looks like a Disney cartoon.
Right.
And then it shows you taking the drug. It shows like the effect of the drug, and it shows it sort of rebalancing out the serotonin. And obviously, it's all based on serotonin. And I could probably find 10 doctors on the street at random and ask them what's the cause of depression, the physical cause of depression, and they would say serotonin. And you're saying that's a myth.
Sure. And the reason I know it's a myth at this point is by looking at all the different kinds of antidepressant drugs, all the different kinds of drugs that are used to treat depression. Now, some of them, but not all of them, some of them are supposed to make more serotonin available in the brain.
Right.
And that's the most common kind. That's what SSRIs are supposed to do. Then there are other kinds of antidepressant drugs, and they're not supposed to affect serotonin at all. These are drugs like NDRIs. They affect other neurotransmitters, but they're not supposed to touch serotonin.
Are those the tricycles or the
tricyclic was an earlier kind of antidepressant.
Okay.
That had a much broader action. It affected serotonin and it affected other neurotransmitters.
Okay. Right.
But now we have these more specific ones, the ones that selectively affect serotonin and don't affect the others, or ones that affect one or two of the others and don't affect serotonin. And then we have the strangest drug of all. It's a drug called tianeptine. It's been licensed by the French medical authorities. It's marketed in France and a number of other countries, European countries, other countries in the world, as an antidepressant. And most antidepressants are SSRIs. We've been batting that about. SSRI stands for Selective Serotonin Reuptake Inhibitor.
Well, let's leave it right there for the moment, and then we'll come right back to what this French drug is, which makes the list here of the Emperor's New Drugs, Exploding the Antidepressant Myth. And then we'll talk about what could work, what does work to cure or at least manage depression next on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett. All right, so Dr. Irving Kirsch, the author of The Emperor's New Drugs, joins us here. It'll be a while before we get to your questions, but they are coming at some point later on in this evening. And I, of course, just ask you to be civil in every way possible on this conversation. And that's because, Dr. Kirsch, a lot of people are very invested in their antidepressants, whether it be the doctors who administer them or their patients. We're literally talking about millions and millions of people who take the pills, believe in the pills, and thousands of doctors who would hate the thought that they've been giving away a total placebo. Yes?
Yeah, that's true. And for a patient, what I would have to say is, look, if you're taking an antidepressant and it's working for you and you're happy with it and you're not troubled by the side effects, then keep taking it by all means. Why should you question that you're not going to be concerned too much about why it works as long as it does work for you? But what I'm more concerned about are the people who take antidepressants and don't get enough benefit from it, or people who take antidepressants and get side effects that are intolerable, or people who take them get better and then get worse again and go into this constant cycle of getting better and relapsing. And for these people, I would think it makes sense to look for alternatives to antidepressants.
All right. Well, I want to hear more about that French drug, but before I do, back up for a second, though. If you're telling people who are on the drugs right now, stay on the drugs if they're working for you, it's a great placebo, won't the effect of the placebo immediately start to diminish the second they start to think of it as a placebo?
Well, I think a lot of people don't think of it as a placebo.
Right.
My reading of the data is that it has to be largely or probably entirely a placebo effect. Maybe I'm wrong. I certainly don't want to take options away from people. I'm more interested in opening up options. If it's working for you, take it. We don't have to wonder about whether it's a placebo or not. And I know people that they've read this. They are depressed. It seems to work for them. And that's their attitude. I don't know whether it's a placebo effect or not, but I know it works for me. And I'm not bothered by the side effects. So I'm going to go back to taking them, or I'm going to continue taking them.
Right. Okay. You were talking about the French drug just before the top of the hour. That
yes.
There's a new drug that's been licensed in France that's different than the selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors. This is a different kind of formulation.
Right. This is a selective serotonin reuptake enhancer. It does exactly the opposite of what the SSRIs are supposed to do. It's an SSRE instead of an SSRI. Instead of making more serotonin available in the brain, it makes less serotonin available in the brain.
Okay.
So now you have drugs that increase serotonin, drugs that decrease serotonin, and drugs that do nothing to serotonin at all being offered as antidepressants.
Okay, that should be a huge clue that they don't know what the hell they're talking about.
It certainly shouldn't. If you want the clue to become even larger, what you have to look is the outcome of the clinical trials where they test these drugs, and the outcome is that they all have the exact same effect. They affect the exact same number of people. If you do an antidepressant trial and you give people SSRIs, 60% get better. If you give them drugs that don't affect serotonin at all, 60% get better. And if you give people this strange new drug that has the exact opposite effect of SSRIs, 60% get better. It's almost uncanny how similar the percentages are in terms of how many people get better, regardless of what drug you give them. And that suggests it can't be something in the drug that's doing it. It can't be the effect on serotonin.
And so if it's not, if serotonin has nothing to do with this, too much, too little, fat, thinner, one color or another, if serotonin has nothing to do with depression, what does?
A lot of things do. Social factors do. We know that economics affect depression. Unemployment affects depression. Unavailability of decent health care options affects depression. That's something that we've known now for decades. When you have economic cycles, those economic cycles produce a change in depression rates. Things that happen in a person's personal life, individual life, can produce depression. Loss of a loved one can lead to depression.
But when we're talking about depression there, we're talking, that's mental depression? Are we talking, what about physical? Because so much of what we're talking about is this biochemical thing in the brain. Is there any biochemical difference between people who are depressed and people who aren't depressed? Or is it just mental?
Well, any time there is something taking place mentally, something is taking place physically. You can take that as a given. So if I'm talking to you and you're hearing my words, things are happening in your brain in response to hearing my words. I'm affecting your brain right now. You're affecting my brain right now. We are affecting the brains of all the listeners out there right now, because any mental state is, in fact, also a state in the brain. We can induce sadness by having people focus on things that happened to them that were very negative in the past, and they can get very, very sad, and we can measure what's happening in the brain, and that causes changes in the brain that are very similar to what you see in the brains of depressed patients.
Okay, but there is no physical change. I'm trying to get an idea about when you talk about the things that cause depression, all right, so all of the bad things that happen in the world can cause to a depressed mental state. Is there any way to treat that depressed mental state physically so that when you adjust the body's physiology, you are then going to have a domino effect on the body's psychology?
Nobody really knows for sure, but there's one hint that it could be, and that is the effects of physical exercise on depression. It's not as well studied as the effects of antidepressant medication, for reasons that I think are economic. Who's going to profit from it? But there have been clinical trials looking at the effect of physical exercise on depression, and the effects you get are about the same as what you get with antidepressants. People get better. They get better doing exercise three times a day, three times a week, 20 minutes a session. It can be aerobic exercise. It can be anaerobic exercise. It doesn't seem to matter, but it has an effect. We don't yet know why it has that effect. It could be a physiological effect. It could be a placebo effect. But just think, if that's a placebo effect, think about the side effects. Side effects of exercise are things like increased sexual function, increased stamina, better muscle tone. Which placebo would you rather have, the antidepressant drug or the physical exercise?
Well, okay, so again, though, if it's a – it's not – it can't be – I mean, there's a – all right. If there was a drug that said, take this pill – and it will have the same effect as though you had exercised five times this week.
Right.
That, based on what you said in the first hour here on in our conversation on Coast to Coast, my impression is that even if they gave you a pill that said this will have the same effect as if you'd exercised five times this week, it couldn't change the body's physiology in that way, right?
Again, it depends what's in the drug. Drugs change the body's physiology.
Right.
Everything changes the body's physiology.
No, I'm saying a placebo. If they give you a drug and say, here, you could take this, it's equal to five times exercising this week, to go back to what you're saying, there are certain things that placebos can't do. A placebo couldn't probably replicate the benefit of an exercise regimen five times a week.
Probably not, but a placebo can replicate many of the benefits that an antidepressant drug has on a person's brain, and that's been studied, and we know that already.
If
you give a depressed person a placebo and they get better, you can see that improvement and changes in the brain, and it's by and large the same changes that you see in people who've gotten better taking the antidepressant.
Oh, no, I get that. I'm just saying, so what's interesting about the exercise is that if somebody's exercising significantly, that the reason why that you could make an argument that it actually is having a change of it's going to change their body chemistry. It can't help but change it because you're increasing your heart rate. You're doing
things, so it almost
it's the natural way to get that high that people are or that sense of well-being, I should be a better way to phrase it.
Right.
When somebody's exercising, they start to feel good about themselves. And it's starting to feel good about themselves that ends up being that domino effect that triggers into, I won't be so depressed now.
And that's very likely a mechanism that's involved in how it is that exercise affects depression. Makes it a wonderful treatment. It's cheap,
right.
It's effective, you can carry it with you. And it has all kinds of additional health benefits as well.
What about diet?
There hasn't been as much studied on the effects of diet on depression. I've seen the hypothesis raised. I've looked at a couple of studies that have been done, and basically there's not enough research on it to be able to say anything one way or another with any degree of confidence. There's one other treatment that has excellent credentials, and that's psychotherapy, and in particular forms of psychotherapy. They tend to be short-lasting treatments lasting between 10 and 20 sessions. They tend to be very focused treatments, focused on the depression. The most well-studied one is a form of treatment called cognitive behavior therapy, or CBT. And in the short term, that produces effects that are comparable to those of antidepressants, which means only slightly better than placebo. But in the long term, its effects are really impressive. People who have gotten better through cognitive behavior therapy tend to stay better. They're much less likely to relapse. There's a wonderful study that's studying people who were given 10 weeks of cognitive behavior therapy, depressed patients, and following them up 6 years later, 60% of them are still free of depression compared to a group who was treated only by drugs and
right.
some supportive counseling, but without the specific therapy, most of whom had relapsed within the first couple of years.
Talk therapy is, I think, very important because it allows you to actually pinpoint or forces you to pinpoint what you may be just sort of dwelling in but not actually articulating. And so, right, I mean, you're suddenly now you're talking about the cause as opposed to living in the feeling.
Sure, and also it helps you learn skills, cognitive skills, ways of interpreting the world, ways of interpreting the events, ways of interpreting yourself, of understanding yourself that not only make you feel better now, but can be used to deal with negative events when they occur in the future.
Talk therapy helps you pinpoint the triggers for what sends you into downward spirals of negative thought.
That's correct.
Yeah, and I think that's something which some people are reluctant to do, and they much more, and it, maybe it's an American thing, maybe it's a human thing, I don't know, but where we much prefer, it would seem, to not want to actually talk about the cause. The cause is messy. The cause can be painful. That whatever those triggers can be, they can often be self-revealing, and you might not want to know something about yourself. And so it's just easier to put your thought into a pill, your hope into a pill, so you don't actually have to address the cause, just only the symptoms.
Right, but it doesn't last as long. And it doesn't last as long because it's not just identifying the triggers, but also figuring out ways to cope with them, learning new skills for coping with those triggers and for dealing with them so that they have a different effect on you in the future than they've had in the past.
We're talking with Dr. Irving Kirsch, the author of The Emperor's New Drugs, Exploding the Antidepressant Myth, SSRIs, work only as placebos, to sum up, to give you the headline of the book, and that the research, especially from the drug companies themselves, was very revealing. That is to say, the research that they were willing to publish. And the other headline that we get when the deeper you get into this story is the number of studies that work against their claims about the efficacy of these drugs that they simply bury, don't publish, claim never existed. That there's just this huge body of research out there that would have disconfirmed all of the things they were trying to tell the FDA and trying to tell the American public, but they just simply kind of let it drift out into the ether.
You know, they had sent those studies to the FDA, but they never made them public beyond that. They'd never published them in journals, and the FDA never made them public. And what we had to do, my fellow researchers and I, was to use the Freedom of Information Act, and we went to the FDA, and we were able to obtain, through the Freedom of Information Act, data on all of the trials that the drug companies had sent to the FDA in order to get these drugs approved. And those are the data that we analyzed and allowed us to reach the conclusion that we did. They were all drug company-sponsored data, them doing their best shot at trying to show their drugs being effective, and are being able to look at not only the studies that came out better that they then published, but also the studies that came out not as well and that they did not publish, but were available to us in the FDA data set.
Well, and the FDA knew this, and they made an active decision to not publish that information, to not make that information even available to doctors so that doctors could see that and then decide for themselves whether or not they were going to prescribe that for their patients.
That's absolutely right, and was one of the things that really shocked me going through the FDA files, because here I found an internal memo in the FDA files in which they talk about the information that many of the clinical trials don't show any difference between drug and placebo, that most doctors are not aware of those trials or even the existence of them, and that the office director at the FDA thought that this information was irrelevant, that prescribing doctors didn't need to know it.
All right. I want to get back to that. I want to talk about the government and their involvement, the U.S. government anyway, if not international governments, and their complicity in this conspiracy of silence on the true efficacy rate of these SSRIs. Again, if you had to sum it up, you would say that the placebo effect is the only effect of these SSRIs. The government knew it, and they didn't stop it because there was a lot of money in it. And there's just not that much money coming to the FDA from the exercise and diet industry. We'll get back to that next on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett. So with the help of a doctor here in the United States, while Dr. Irving Kirsch is in England and using FOIA, they were able to get to these studies, which the folks with the FDA and the drug companies would probably wish they hadn't. These were surveys that were done on the effectiveness of these drugs, these SSRIs, and they showed essentially what became Dr. Kirsch's point, that these were just placebos. They only worked because people believed that they worked, and that there really was no significant actual biochemical difference being made by these drugs except for the side effects. And so the FDA knew this. How early do you think the FDA knew this to be true?
Well, they knew as soon as they started approving drugs that the difference between drug and placebo was relatively small. I think they assumed it was a real difference. I think they were not just being duplicitous about that, but they were honest about that.
At the beginning.
But it was a small difference, and that's what they didn't I've seen that referred to by my colleagues as the dirty little secret in the pharmaceutical literature, and the FDA certainly played their role in keeping it a secret.
Well, okay, but it's and so we can argue about what's a significant difference in the placebo rate or whatever, but it comes right down to it is, yeah, they kept this to themselves. They didn't tell anybody, and that's only at the beginning. At some point, there starts to be a repetition of these surveys, which if they were interested in putting all the cards up on the table, they could have done that. So it may have not started off being duplicitous, but at some point, they were serving the interests of the pharmaceutical industry and not the American consumer.
Well, yeah, there's a couple of things that happened. First of all, these are not just surveys. They're clinical trials. They are the studies which become the basis for approving a medication, for prescribing, for allowing doctors to prescribe it or not. And a couple of things happened. One thing that happened was the FDA started receiving government funding to do their work, drug company funding, rather, to do their work. And up there, up to the last I heard, it was about 40% of their budget came directly from the pharmaceutical companies. So that put some pressure on them, and that has led some people in the FDA to regard the drug company rather than the American people as their client, the person they have to please, the person they have to work for. The other thing that happened that was really strange was back in 2006. It came out that some of the drug companies had wanted to put out some information indicating that not all of their clinical trials were successful, and the FDA urged them not to, and this became the subject of congressional hearings.
Right. This is something we've talked a lot about, so, I mean, in a way, it's much more old news on this show, but I think it's, for still a lot of people out there, even just the mention that this was possible is shocking and new, And that's the part that seems unfair and seems like it's – I mean, the amount of advertising, for example, that just keeps highlighting that these drugs work, when they know really comes right down to it, they only work as a placebo, and the FDA knows that too. But that's where the money comes from for the FDA. You know, it's – that's how they see, in some cases at least, and you had that quote in the book about how – the FDA refers to the pharmaceutical industry as their client.
Right.
Yeah, as opposed to the American people. So what can be done? What should be done about this?
Well, one thing I think that needs to be done is to get rid of the secrecy. These clinical trials need to be made public. All of them need to be published. The data from them need to be made available to independent researchers. That's one thing that I think is critical. Stop the ability of companies that have vested economic interests from being able to own the data, hide the data, put out what they want, keep back what they want. That's one thing. I think needs to be done with that is to de-link the funding of regulatory agencies from direct contributions by the drug companies, so that once again they can become the watchdogs for the American people rather than the watchdogs for the drug companies. I mean, right now, if you think an analogy, imagine that you've got a guard dog and you have a set of thieves, and what you do is you give the thieves the task of feeding the guard dog. It's not going to be a very effective guard dog anymore.
Right. And now, if it's true for the SSRIs, what other drugs could this also be true for? How many drugs are, really barely passable or not passable when you look at, if we could actually get a look at all of the evidence? And you hate to think that in a democracy, in a free society, we have to get a FOIA in order to get to the studies that they should have been giving to the doctors so that they knew whether or not they want to prescribe it for their patients.
Absolutely. And, I assume that most of our medications are effective medications. Drugs have done wonders and can do wonders, but there are economic interests in selling the drugs, and that's not the. If you're interested in
right.
recouping your money, making your money, that's not going to lead you to do the same things than if you're interested in just evaluating and partially and finding out what works and what doesn't.
Well, I know this isn't the first time the FDA has been busted for withholding important information from the very same people to whom they are charged to protect. However, you know, they always say that if you catch somebody, every time that you find a drunk driver is arrested, He's probably already done it 12 other times before the very first time that he's ever arrested. It makes you really wonder how many other times the FDA has done this before and how often that that their model is to do it and then to let the market sort it out. Let the market be the one that decides which drugs make it and don't make it. And I think that's the wrong approach. Why have an FDA at all under those circumstances?
I agree completely. And there does need to be more openness. There needs to be a division of funding so that the FDA is clearly working for the American people and not for the pharmaceutical industry. And there needs to be enforced openness. If a drug is going to be licensed, the research behind it ought to be in the public domain. You need to protect the rights of the patients who participated in the trial so their identity doesn't get revealed. That's easy, and it's important. But the basic data, how depressed was this person, what were they given, what were they told, male, female, age, ethnic background, how did they respond, what side effects did they have, all of that should be made available so that people who are independent of the drug company can reanalyze the data.
Are the SSRIs as a class of drugs, are they the most egregious example you've encountered as a researcher into placebos of popular drugs that are really just a placebo effect?
Yeah, I haven't done a lot of, you know, I was never interested in being a drug researcher, so that's someplace that maybe I will be going next. What other drugs will we find that to be true of? I kind of backed into this out of my interest in the placebo, and I backed into it with not just the SSRIs, but antidepressants in general, because it doesn't matter what antidepressant you're looking at. They all have the same effect. They all have basically the same lack of effect.
And so as your interest in placebo goes, do we have as a society, if you had to look at the pantheon of the biggest names in pharmaceuticals, do we have in the United States the most placebos? Do we have more of them than, say, other cultures that are using, you know, a tree bark and a squirrel's tail? I mean, where do we rank in terms of our belief in placebos, wittingly or unwittingly?
Well, I think every culture has its placebos, just has different placebos. The tree bark may also be a placebo. So we have different kinds of placebos, and we have placebos that have seem more scientific sounding, and other cultures might have placebos that seem more faith-based. But we all have placebos. One thing that we do have is we probably have more active medications that actually are beneficial than most other cultures.
I hope would be true. But I mean, you look at like China and all of the those cures for, say, you know, erectile dysfunction, like grinding up a rhinoceros penis or whatever it is that is the thing that they're supposed to do. And it makes you think, okay, well, no wonder it is still a popular belief. That's the power of the placebo effect. They probably are seeing a benefit. They probably are seeing greater arousal because they believe that will work.
That's right. And just about anything you can imagine has been used as a treatment that we would now consider a placebo and seems to have been used successfully by physicians all over the world, in the West, in the East, anywhere you go.
Now, what's your life like? As you have been talking about this and you've been putting this word out there, how well have you been received? What's the peer reaction like, or the popular reaction to this book and to the series of articles you published before the book came out?
Well, it started out with disbelief. People just couldn't believe it was true. They said, well, but we know these drugs are effective. Everybody knows these drugs are effective. And that's what led me to continue the research. First study I did was on published literature, having had this response of people saying, well, it's hard to believe. My colleagues and I went and used the Freedom of Information Act, got new data, looked at the data more carefully. Little by little, I think the message is seeping in. I know after my most recent meta-analysis of the clinical trials was published, got front page coverage here in the UK in all of the major newspapers, and about 3 months later, a survey was taken of physicians here in the UK, and 44% of them said that on the basis of this research, they would now begin looking for alternative treatments to prescribe to their patients rather than prescribing antidepressants. So I found that very encouraging. And I'm hoping that the publication of my new book in the U.S. coming out next week, I believe, might have a similar effect there.
Again, the book is, and it's a really good read. You make it very accessible. It's not like reading, you know, JAMA or something. You have to feel like you've got a Ph.D. level reader. The Emperor's New Drugs, Exploding the Antidepressant Myth. Dr. Irving Kirsch has been our guest. We'll get to your phone calls coming up. But, you know, I guess I know what my email is going to be like after the show. It's going to be because I know what it was like when I mentioned that you were coming. And I was getting emails from people saying, so you're telling me, you're trying to tell me that my depression, which has these pills have made my life livable. I wouldn't even be here if it weren't for these pills. You're trying to tell me that I'm just deluding myself. And I said, first of all, I'm not. Irving Kirsch is. But then I said, blame him. But I was quoting what I knew about the book already to them. And people don't like to be told that they've been being fooled.
Yeah. And I understand that. And one of the things, again, I would say to them is, perhaps we're doing the research wrong. Perhaps we don't really know how to evaluate these drugs. Maybe these drugs are effective for some group of people that we haven't yet identified and not for others. Maybe they're hurting some people and helping other people, and the net effect is a wash when you just look at everybody. But if that's the case, you need to find out who they're hurting and stop giving it to those people, and then maybe the if you study just the people who are left, be a small minority of depressed patients, you might find that you're getting some real benefit. I can't exclude that, and I wouldn't try to exclude that as a possibility.
But so far, no matter how you've sliced it so far, though, you've yet to find the group that benefits.
Yeah, nobody's found it. Nobody has identified. If there is one, there may be one. Nobody has found it. The closest we can come to that, now even that I think is it can be explained as a placebo effect. What we can say is theoretically that may be true. Theoretically that may be true, but if it's true, you've got to go out and you've got to find it, and then you've got to look at to the extent that that's true. If there aren't any real differences between drug and placebo overall, and some people are really getting a drug effect, then some people must be getting hurt by the drug, and you've got to find out which is which if you're going to responsibly prescribe the medication.
There are many countries, Ireland being one of them, that have either banned or limited the sale of SSRIs, especially to teenagers, but even to adults. Some of these have already come into question. If a country decides we're going to ban SSRIs, period, and we'll go with something else, we'll wait for the next drug to come along or whatever it is. What do you think would happen?
Well, you can't just ban a treatment without giving an alternative treatment. First of all, you can't just stop giving SSRIs to people who have been taking that. Among other things, many people show withdrawal symptoms, and they can be quite severe. So if you just quit taking SSRIs, you can have some very negative reactions.
Yeah, they got to come down on them like they might any other kind of drug. But I just mean, what do you think would happen societally if people had to give up on the SSRIs?
The question is, will other treatments be provided? If other treatments are provided, if alternatives are provided, then I don't think there would be any problem with that at all. And you might have a true decrease in depression rates if the more effective treatments like cognitive behavior therapy are made widely enough available to use when people are depressed. If you don't do anything, depression doesn't go away. You have to do something to treat it.
Actively.
And that we know from our research. People don't get this benefit if they're not even given a placebo. Something has to be done.
But if, and this is the bottom line, as we go into the next hour on Coast to Coast, that if you are suffering from depression and you're listening, you know, to the sound of our voices, you would say, you would recommend talk therapy and exercise, focus on that, and wean yourself off of the SSRIs. If, I mean, all things being equal, if they're willing to do that, that talk therapy and exercise will bring about a greater lifetime change, a more permanent change than just staying on the drugs.
Yes, I would add just do that in consultation with your physician. Don't just try and go off your medication on your own, but look for alternatives.
Yeah. Well, that's where we'll leave it. The phones are very active. Everybody's got something to say. The Emperor's New Drugs, Exploding the Antidepressant Myth. Dr. Irving Kirsch is the one who went into this survey, if you missed the very beginning. He went into this research, rather, at the very beginning, expecting to be able to prove that antidepressants worked in at least one group, in the most severely depressed, for example. But the more he did the research and the more studies he began to try to follow and to coordinate, the more he realized that the placebo effect was the only effect that these drugs were having. The only significant effect these drugs were having was from the belief in the people that were taking them that they would have an effect. In effect, they were treating their depression about their depression. They felt better about their depression because they were doing something. And then their depression got better. Is that you? Was that you? Where are you with the Emperor's New Drugs next on Coast to Coast? This is Ian Punnett. So we pick it up with, let's start with the person who's been waiting the longest, Brenda, east of the Rockies in Old River, Texas, for Dr. Irving Kirsch. Brenda?
Hello there.
Hi.
This is such a great program. Dr. Kirsch, thank you so much for coming out to this. I've been trying to tell my doctor for the past year the same thing that you're saying, that all it is side effects. And, in fact, he thinks I'm on them right now and thinks I'm doing so well. I haven't taken a one. I mean, I tried it, you know, but I'm on a medication that's supposed to interferon that's supposed to, there's suicides with people that take these, this medicine that they have me on.
Right.
And actually, if I took the antidepressants like I'm supposed to, they would make me commit suicide because of the side effects. And he's got me, he thinks I'm on one right now. I hope he's not listening. It's called a new one. I don't know if I can say a name on the air or not. Prestique. He said, oh, this one has less side effects. I wouldn't know. I haven't tried it. He said, well, you have to give it a chance. Well, the only chance is you've got to get right with yourself. I mean, everybody's going to have their ups and downs, but you are so right, and I thought I was just finally, I thought maybe this was all in my mind, but I agree 100% with you.
Well, you're on the cutting edge. Go ahead, doctor.
I was just saying thank you, and I appreciate the struggle that you're going through with that, and I just wish you were in a position where you could have a more open relationship with your physician and be comfortable letting him know your experience.
Well, doesn't that speak to kind of another problem that comes up with physicians? And this is also something which we're seeing a lot of, and I don't know whether the same is true in England. But the surveys about the number of minutes that a doctor now will spend typically with a patient really doesn't get to know the patient like they want to. And they pretty much have sort of a top-down authority relationship with the patient. Here's what you need. I have the knowledge. You do this. It'll get better. And if you don't do that, then there's a frustration on the part of the physician and not a sense of, oh, well, I need to adjust to help this patient at all.
I think that's absolutely right. And one good part of what's often called the placebo effect is the relationship between the doctor and the patient. There does have to be enough time, there has to be enough caring, and there has to be someone who's willing to listen and communicate that they've been able to listen and able to hear, not just listen, but able to hear what their patients have to say. I've been to great doctors, and I've been to terrible doctors, I have to say, and it's really a question of openness, listening and caring, and time.
All right. First time caller Lisa is in Florida on Coast to Coast for Dr. Irving Kirsch. Lisa?
Hi, Ian.
Hi.
Hi, Dr. Kirsch. Well, first thing I want to say is, Ian, if you take these antidepressants, you can just, well, for me, forget about sex completely.
Oh, really?
Oh, completely.
That's your experience on that?
I mean, it's the last thing on my mind.
Right.
But what I wanted to ask the doctor, because I've been taking three different things for a long time, and I said to myself, I feel the same.
Mm.
They're not changing. They're not helping me. So I figured this is what I wanted to ask the doctor. I stopped them, not all at once.
Yeah.
You know, I figure I'm a doctor. So I stopped them very slowly,
mm-hmm.
and all of a sudden, I started hallucinating.
Mm.
All my friends asked me and said, "What's wrong with you?
Yeah.
You don't sound right. You don't look right.
Mm.
You're not making any sense."
Mm.
And it was the scariest thing I ever went through. I mean, for anybody that's taking them, you have to be so careful. Am I right?
Yeah. What happened then? How did you stop that? How did you get out of that terrible state?
Well, I called my doctor
mm-hmm.
because I was going out of my mind.
Yep.
And he said, "Yeah, I don't believe you did this. You're going to kill yourself." I said,
yeah.
"No, I'm not." He said, "Get right back on them
mm-hmm.
now." And I did,
mm-hmm.
and I'm okay now. But, boy, I went off them so slowly, doctor.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know how you go off them.
Yeah, there's a book by an author by the name of Glenn Mullen. He's on the staff at Harvard University, and he's written a book to help patients and their doctors figure out how to go off antidepressants without kicking in some of these withdrawal syndromes. Now, whether that's what was happening with you or not, I don't know. But it's a very informative book. I believe the name is Joseph Glenn Mullen. You might try looking that up and taking a look and see how what he is recommending, how that and his information, how that fits with your experience, and then talking about that with your doctor. But it's important, if you're going to try altering medical treatment, to do so in consultation with your doctor. I'm a firm believer of that.
I was actually checked that story I mentioned to you before about the case of somebody that was claiming that their entire sexual orientation had changed as a result of being on these antidepressants, and that they actually got very sexually active for a period that they could not explain. And I found I found an article here that was posted in October of 2008. And it was interesting. It was just all about that exact same thing about that. So that's what I say before about the sexuality part. I have no personal experience with that, and I'm certainly willing to stipulate that for most people it's a loss of sexual desire. But for other people, at least a minority, it seems to be something that they did not anticipate. It suddenly increased sexual activity, and in a way that they never would have predicted about themselves. Lynn is in Phoenix on Coast to Coast on a wild card line for Dr. Irving Kirsch. Lynn?
Hi. Good evening, gentlemen. How are you?
Fine. Hi.
Hi. I have several comments to make. First of all, I lived in the D.C. area and was very close friends with somebody who was familiar with how the pharmaceutical industry and the FDA pretty much sleep in bed together. Mm. And most of the heads of the drug companies or people within various departments, it's kind of their dream job upon retirement or leaving these companies to become a board member of the FDA, just basically to make sure that their drugs get through the market. And in my own personal studies, on another note, of, you know, the drug industry, especially the psychotropics, you know, have just, it's amazing to me. There is a lot of hiding of what they're doing. I mean, the FDA definitely pushes through so many drugs. And just as an example, Paxil is one of the drugs that's on the market. And now I'm seeing in the market area on television, you know, that there are major issues and lawsuits that are being promoted by attorneys just recently on Paxil for serious side effects. And my contention is that, I mean, and I've studied this a lot, my contention is that these drug companies do know what's going on. The studies are done, and I've seen the surveys on this. The studies are done with certain patients to produce certain outcomes because they do know that we have, you know, different pathways that affect these drugs. So they're very set up and staged in the studies that they do.
Okay. Dr. Kirsch?
Well, certainly, one of the things that happens in all of these studies is that people who are the most likely to respond to placebo are screened out of them, and they're also people who are least likely to respond to treatment are screened out. So the studies are designed in a way to increase the likelihood of detecting some kind of a drug effect. Now, that's part of what I've found so shocking is if the drug company studies that are designed to maximize the likelihood of finding an effect, if they can't find a decent-sized effect, then there's probably no real effect there to be found at all.
Okay. Nina is in St. Louis on a wild card line for Dr. Irving Kirsch. Nina?
Hey, guys. Hi. Thank you for taking my call. Well, that previous call couldn't have been more perfect for mine. I was kicked out of a study that was done on Zoloft.
How about
because
that?
Because I started showing suicidal effects.
So they didn't want you in the study.
Mm-mm.
For you, or did they ask you to get off the drugs because they didn't want you to commit suicide, obviously?
Okay, well, I went into it for post-traumatic stress disorder.
Okay.
All right. Was on Zoloft for probably 4 or 5 months, doing fine. Then came the blind part of the study, and everybody was split up into, you know, a placebo or continued on with the drug.
Right.
After about, it was either 1 or 2 months after that I went back in and started filling out my little questionnaire, which you filled out every time you went in, which was, do you have any inclination to hurt yourself, anyone else? And they ask you that a half dozen different ways. And anyway, I started checking yes, 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 yes for the first time, and was shocked when the doctor pulled me into his office. He informed me, he says, I'm sorry, but you no longer fit the criteria for our study any longer. Here's 3 months worth of Zoloft. You were in the placebo group, and you're going to have to find your own doctor to get a prescription for this.
They said you were in the placebo group.
Yes. So what had occurred was the withdrawal symptoms that happen when you go off of the drug, the severe withdrawal symptoms, it's a serotonin storm. And maybe Dr. Kirsch can explain that, that works.
Dr. Kirsch, how would you explain this to Nina?
Well, as she's saying, there are effects that can occur when you go off the drugs, when you're taking a serotonin-altering drug and you suddenly go off it, there can be a series of side effects, and the feelings that might lead you to consider suicide can be part of it. Sometimes it very much resembles depression. Typically, the onset of those tend to be fairly quick. It's hard to speak about any one particular case and any one particular person's experience, but we do know that going off of antidepressants can trigger withdrawal symptoms.
Okay, but wait. I'm confused about something. I thought she said that the doctor said, even though she was identifying I'm having suicidal tendencies, the doctor said, well, you were in the placebo group. How
right.
could the placebo be causing suicidal tendencies?
Because she was, she may have been on the drug group before. It depends on the design of the trial. It sounds like it was probably what's called a relapse prevention trial, where they're taking people who have been assigned to the drug group in the first part of the trial and have done well, and then randomize them to either stay on the drug or to be put on placebo, and that's done double blind. So then they are taken off the drug, some of them, in order to see what happens when you do that. From the time periods that she described, it sounds like that could be what was going on.
Ree is in Salt Lake City on a wild card line on Coast to Coast for Dr. Irving Kirsch.
Good morning, Ian. Good morning, Dr. Kirsch.
Good morning.
My name is Ree, and I'm 47 years old. And when I was 22, I was finally diagnosed with bipolar disorder. I was in the hospital for a month and a half, which I found out was also manic depressive because I have really high highs and really low lows. Now, this was after years and years of trying to, let's say, leave the planet because I was that depressed. There's a difference between depression because of the economy and depression because you can't explain why you're depressed. And so my meds have been working for me. I've been taking them, and when I'm not on them, that's when I end up in the hospital again. But my main question for you was, why do you think it's psychotropic drugs that are being targeted as placebos? This is the whole thing that just doesn't really sit well with me.
Okay. First of all, let me say that all of the comments that I have made and what I address in the book have to do with antidepressants for the treatment of major depression, not for the treatment of what's called bipolar disorder or manic depression. That's a whole different thing, and I really have nothing to say about that. I don't. There very well may be a drug effect that's very important, that's very large in the treatment of bipolar disorder. I haven't studied those data, and so I can't speak to them at all. What I'm speaking to is the use of antidepressants for major depression, which what they're primarily targeted for, and there we see a placebo effect that's very large and a very small, bordering on non-significant, in clinical terms, non-meaningful drug effect. And that's just what the data show us. And that's why we focus on them.
Miles in Anaheim, California, on a wild card line for Dr. Irving Kirsch. Miles?
Hi, Dr. Kirsch. Hi, Ian. I was curious if Dr. Kirsch has ever suffered from depression.
I haven't suffered from major clinical depression. I have been depressed. I have the normal ups and downs and times that I feel sad and times that I feel great. I've worked with a lot of depressed people. I used to have a psychotherapy practice when I lived in the U.S. And when I was teaching at the University of Connecticut. And I worked with people who were mildly, moderately, severely, and very severely depressed. And so I know what it's like to work with these people and to live with these people.
Okay. Because I've been diagnosed for the last 28 years, misdiagnosed until 3 years ago. I've been a guinea pig, basically, and then I was finally diagnosed as bipolar type 2. So that's I was kind of curious, and definitely enjoyed listening to you and looking forward to reading your book. So
that's very helpful.
And again, don't automatically generalize what I've said about the antidepressants for major depression to treatment for bipolar disorder. may be similar, it may be very different, and you can't just say, well, this is what it is with depression. It must be the same story with bipolar.
Let me see, just by any chance, we can get Tom in before the bottom of the hour break. Tom?
Oh, thank you, and doctor, for doing his job. I'm grateful for it. I've had my own battle with PTSD and suicide and depression.
Right.
Oh. But I had a couple questions for you, and I'd like to take it off there, but first I had a statement. My own treatment, I was diagnosed with Reiter's syndrome. I was on antibiotics for a year, and then avoiding the toxic chemicals and changes in diet was 7 weeks to emotional recovery, a book by Dr. Joanne Matthew Larson.
Okay, we're going to run out of time here.
Okay,
just
there's a peer-reviewed journal from Environmental Health Perspective about toxic chemicals being the main cause of mental illness. And then also there's a biomonitoring bill going through the Congress right now to start testing people for toxic chemicals, because they've checked less than 6% of them. You could find it on a blog, Toxic Reverend blog.
Let's do that. We'll get to that coming up. Tom, I appreciate that. Dr. Irving Kirsch, when we come back, well, you will address that issue of the just where Tom has it there, about toxic chemicals causing depression, the relationship between toxic chemicals. Have you read anything about that in any of these surveys when we come back? On Coast to Coast, this is Ian Punnett. Rebecca is in Houston on Coast to Coast for Dr. Irving. Oh, wait, sorry. Rebecca, hang on to that thought. I forgot to give Dr. I got all excited. Forgot to ask Dr. Kirsch about the toxic chemicals first. I'll be right back. Rebecca, don't go anywhere. Dr. Kirsch, so Tom's question before the break there about the effect of toxic chemicals. Did you see much of that in your studies at all on depression?
I haven't. That doesn't mean it doesn't exist, and it's certainly plausible that toxic chemicals or just about anything else could have an effect on depression. It's certainly not the answer to what causes depression, but I haven't looked into the research on toxic chemicals and depression carefully, and so I can't really comment on it more than that.
I wonder whether, and this is just, you know, two guys talking, I wonder whether you were looking for a group that might be affected, might be changed. If people had a high amount of toxicity in their system, then by introducing something like an SSRI, or I wonder whether they might enjoy a benefit from that. That might be one of the weird, you know, instead of the depression being caused by the serotonin levels, but it may be a depression caused by toxicity in the system.
Well, you know, anything is possible until you study it. The thing we need to do is identify people in clinical trials and see who they are. I suppose if there's a subgroup who are doing well because their depression is caused by toxic chemicals, one of the things you might want to do is find out why are they getting exposed to these toxic chemicals and what can be done about that.
Right. A lot of occupational thing, I would imagine. Right. Rebecca's in Houston on Coast to Coast. Thank you for your patience. You're talking with Dr. Kirsch. Go ahead, Rebecca.
Hi. The book sounds wonderful. I'm 52 years old. I have been depressed for as long as I can remember, even as a child. Mm-hmm. I was never treated until I guess I was in my early 20s with tricyclics.
Right.
And therapy, talk therapy. And I seemed to do all right, and I got better, I thought. And I got off the medication, and I did all right, and I had some more depression maybe 10 years later.
Yeah.
And the doctor put me on the new ones, the SSRI. I hated it. I just couldn't deal with it, and I decided that I just wasn't going to take these drugs, and that I had lived with depression, and I could learn to live with it, you know, and maybe with talk therapy. But recently, I became homeless, and I had to go to a behavioral place in town for free service, and they wanted to put me on SSRIs because, of course, I was depressed. I said, well, everybody would be depressed if they're
homeless.
Situation.
Right, yeah. Exactly.
And I'm not going on that medication. And I said, you know, give me Elavil. That worked for me a long time ago.
The tricyclics?
Yeah. And they said, no, nobody prescribes that. We're not going to do that. You're going to go on on this? And I said, no, I'm not. Mm. How do you not sound crazy? Every doctor
right.
I've ever been to has always wanted to put me on depression medication, and I tell them that I do better dealing with it myself than with medication. And
okay. Well, let's give Dr. Kirsch a chance to respond to that, because I think you've brought up already three great questions in there.
Okay.
Irving, go ahead.
Yeah, one great question is giving patients choice. People do better if they're empowered. People do better when they have some say into what kind of treatment that they get, and when their doctors listen to them and take their preferences into account. So that's one thing. I was interested to hear that talk therapy seemed to be part of what helped before, and then I wondered, well, maybe that might help again. Sometimes we're just too quick to reach for the pill. It seems like the easy solution. In the long run, if you need the pills to maintain functioning, it can be the most expensive solution also.
Right. But she mentioned the tricyclics, the original class of antidepressant medications.
Right.
She wants to go back on them again, and they won't let her. Do they still make them?
Yeah, they still make them, and people are still prescribed tricyclics. They are not, as a group and for people as a whole, they're neither more nor less effective than the newer antidepressants. They do tend, as a group, to have more severe side effects than the SSRIs. But that never speaks to any particular individual's experience, and there still are certainly prescriptions written for tricyclic medication.
And how do you talk to a doctor about that without sounding crazy? I would say bring in a copy of Dr. Irving Kirsch's book. I know financially you may not be in a good place maybe right now yet, Rebecca, but at least go to the library and print out from Amazon.com the first couple of pages from the book, which you can do,
Print
out the cover if the library has the book. Doesn't come out till next week here, but when your library gets it, be able to show it to your doctor and say, look, this is why I don't want to do that. And he'll have greater respect, I hope, for your opinion on that. Joe, first time caller line on Coast to Coast. Joe?
Hi, Ian. How are you?
Hi, you're talking with Dr. Irving Kirsch.
Hi, Dr. Kirsch. I have a question. Do you in your study do any did you do a study on weather, on how people are affected by the weather?
No, excuse me. I didn't do any of the studies myself. These were all studies that were done by the drug companies. And they're the studies that the drug companies sent to the FDA when they were getting their drugs approved. And what I did was to get the data from the FDA and analyze those data.
Have you heard anything along those lines about how weather does affect people?
There's a disorder called seasonal affective disorder in which people can become depressed during different seasons, and that might be linked to changes in weather.
Hey, Joe, have you heard that the number one treatment for that is the UV lamp thing? Right?
Yes, sir. Yes. Yes.
Have you tried that?
Yes, sir. In fact, that's kind of odd that you brought that up, because I've been suffering for about 21, 22 years now. And like the doctor said, you have to find a positive place to go. And my positive place to go through depression was through exercise and running and marathons and triathlons. And,
right.
You know, I mean, I became so bad that I felt that I looked bad in front of people. So I would kind of cover up my depression through, you know, either going to a team event and looking good
right.
or through exercise or whatever. But I just wanted to say that depression is just overwhelming, you know.
Yeah.
It's something you can't put a Band-Aid on.
I know. I know. And I know it's been tough for you. Are you glad you did the exercise route more than doing the drugs?
Well, I do both. I try to fight through both, and then it becomes a psychological thing in your mind. Do I really need these drugs, or should I just run? Because you think, wow, I feel great when I'm running and when I'm done, because you achieve something, you're happy. You know,
how about talk therapy, Joe?
Oh, yeah, that's great.
You've done a lot of that? Okay.
Yeah.
I'm glad you shared. I think that, and of course, never do anything without consulting your physician, but you might find that the drugs might end up just have been an expensive experiment that may not, in the end, be giving you the benefit that just the running alone would do. John is in Lamont, Pennsylvania, wildcard line on Coast to Coast for Dr. Irving Kirsch. John?
Hey, good evening, Ian. Hey, have your screener give Rebecca my phone number. I'll give her some talk therapy. We'll talk about how desperate these doctors are to push these drugs.
Yeah. Talk about that. You mean this is in your experience, too, then, too, John?
Oh, my, yes. I wanted to suggest something for future studies that you might want to look at. I think I understand how these drugs operate. I mean, maybe not on a biochemical level, but at least mentally what they do. And just a quick background, Ian, you really got my fangs out on this tonight, because what happened to me is I had severe dehydration. I was having heart problems, and I lost 50 pounds of weight in 3 months without trying. And I was having breathing difficulties, and it turned out it was a combination of dehydration, and apparently I had side effects from a blood pressure medication they had just recently put me on. And anyway, all they wanted to do is push antidepressants. I was prescribed Prozac and Zoloft, and that was it. I was told I was just depressed. And well, when I finally kept ending up in the emergency room and was told that you're dehydrated, you can't keep coming in here every couple of weeks to get another 3 liters of fluid pumped into you. You should see a doctor about this. And I was, oh gee, I thought I was. But what I wanted to suggest, from hearing the few people that I have that had any success at all with SSRIs, in combination with all the what seem to be severe problems that people have, Ian, the issues you were bringing up, all the way from the school shooters to you were talking about the sexual obsessives. May suddenly be an issue in some people. I think what these drugs do simply is remove inhibitions, things that people normally would not have acted out on, may have thought of, may have wanted to do, but wouldn't have in a million years actually done. I think these drugs simply remove inhibitions, and in a few people, maybe, and this is what I wanted to suggest for further study, if you do that, maybe that's the group of, rare group of people that these can actually have any effect on. But I think the danger is you're playing with fire, and you remove too much inhibition, or you remove inhibition in the wrong person that may have some violent or other kind of inclination, and it's disastrous.
All right. And good, so interesting thought. I'm glad you jumped in. Thanks, John. Dr. Kirsch, anything you want to comment on that?
Well, it is an interesting talk, and it was very interesting to hear how exercise seemed to help in managing it, and who knows whether the antidepressants added to that or detracted from it. Some evidence that it might detract from the effects of exercise on depression. But I remember when treating depressed patients, that for many, many people, they would go out, they would start running, or they would do some other kind of exercise, and they reported immediate benefits that were really at times astounding. It becomes an excellent way of helping to control mood problems that may be produced by who knows what, by adverse life. Maybe by some toxic chemicals, but exercising can be a tremendous gift.
Joy is in Santa Cruz on a wildcard line on Coast to Coast for Dr. Irving Kirsch. Joy?
Good morning, Dr. Kirsch and Ian. First, just before I get to the main reason I call, I just wanted to mention that one thing we might want to do is cluster studies to find out if people who have depression in certain areas are near toxic chemicals.
Hmm.
Okay.
I think it would be a worthy pursuit to look at.
That would be a very interesting thing to do. I agree.
But I used to have panic attacks, and I had them because I was exposed to Lyme disease, which plays with the endocrine system and plays with your the thing that makes your heart race.
Okay.
Anyway, so for a while there, I was on Xanax, and I found after a certain point, I was getting too dependent on Xanax. So
So I started backing off on how much I took. I cut it down to half. I cut it down to a quarter. And then I just carried the bottle in my purse. And I didn't have any more panic attacks.
Just by having it there if you needed it took away the need to have it.
Exactly.
Yeah. I love that.
I love that, too. I'm wondering if maybe an opposite way of looking at drugs, just having it there just in case you think you need it.
Yeah,
you know, you're not alone in that. And I've heard stories like that where just having something in one's purse that or one's pocket or one's wallet that you know you can do, and then you never use it.
Robin is in Oakland, California on Coast to Coast for Dr. Irving Kirsch. Robin?
Hi, Ian. Deus te amat, so do I.
Thank you.
And hi, doctor. How are you?
I'm fine. How are you?
Well, I wanted to ask you, do you know offhand whether or not people who have taken SSRIs are any more likely to develop fibromyalgia?
I don't know. I have not seen that as a risk factor as or as a side effect of taking SSRIs. It's certainly not on the list. It's a fairly long list of potential side effects that are published in the information leaflets that are packaged sometimes with the medications. I'm not aware of that. Doesn't
I'm glad,
mean it doesn't happen, but I'm not aware of it.
I'm glad Robin brought up fibromyalgia. A lot of doctors think of that as a phantom disease. They think of it as something which isn't really happening to the body, and so, you know, they get, but some people, especially the women I know that suffer from it, they have found comfort in taking certain types of painkillers. And I actually thought of fibromyalgia when you were talking about some painkillers having a placebo effect, and I wondered whether there's some, you know, footsie on that with when it comes to fibromyalgia. But we'll have to wait for another time for that. Michael is in Eugene, Oregon on Coast to Coast for Dr. Irving Kirsch. Michael?
Hi, Ian. Hi, Dr. Kirsch. Definitely another great show. I'm definitely going to order your book. It's interesting how some of your – I have a great question. It's interesting how some of your sponsors, commercials tonight, are about curing clinical depression and anxiety, and I'm sure they're being inundated with calls this evening. And let me say that it's like one of the things that's a good treatment for me is listening to your shows.
Okay. Well, glad to hear that.
All the
mentally stimulated.
It really is, and it keeps me company at night when I am
good.
Feeling alone and depressed. I was told by a psychiatrist years ago that approximately 80% of the population in the country is on some form of prescription drugs, and it's like I've asked a couple other people that, and they say it's true. And I was wondering if you knew what percentage is for depression, and also.
All right, let's get an answer to that one, Dr.
Sure.
Kirsch. What do we know about that?
About 15% of all drugs that are prescribed in the U.S. are prescribed for depression.
And what about 80% of the country being medicated at one time or another?
I haven't heard that figure, but that would sound right to me. I would be surprised if it wasn't even higher. I wouldn't be surprised if it wasn't even
International
higher.
International Line, Tanya in British Columbia, in the last minute we have, but I know you've been hanging on, so we can squeeze you in here real fast, Tanya, if you can keep it short.
Okay, I've been severely depressed for about 10 years, and every time my depression gets worse, they keep bumping up my medication, and I want to find out how to get off of it.
Yeah, how to get off of it, you need to talk with your physician. The pumping up of medication, there doesn't seem to be much of a relationship between the dose of the antidepressant and its therapeutic benefit. That much is pretty clear on the clinical trials, but you can't just get off of antidepressant medication on your own. You have to do that carefully. You have to do it in consultation with your doctor, and you have to find an alternative, whether it be talk therapy, exercise, self-help books like David Burns' Feeling Good, an excellent book that's been tested in clinical trials. All of them are excellent. But you have to do something.
Tanya, I'd say step one, get a new doctor. I don't know if you can, but because I know you're in Canada and I don't know how the system works, but I mean that may be the first thing. Get a new conversation partner anyway on your depression. Dr. Irving Kirsch, thank you so much. I hope you've enjoyed it.
I've enjoyed it greatly. Thank you for having me on, Ian.
You were delightful. The Emperor's New Drugs, Exploding the Antidepressant Myth. Highly recommend to people who are in this category. to get StreamLink and listen to the show from the beginning. I think it's great. Grab the book when it comes out. Should be available very shortly. If you order it online, they'll get it to you right away. Deus te amat, and I do too.